This is a podcast from the University of Manchester's Jodrell Bank Centre for Astrophysics. For more information, see jodcast.net.
In the news this month, superflies on sun-like stars, speedy Martian sand dunes, and a decision on the site for the Square Kilometre Array. Solar flares are energetic but short-lived eruptions in the atmosphere of the sun. Most of the time they barely affect the Earth, but occasionally one heads in our direction and is strong enough to cause aurora and affect satellites. Some stars have been observed to produce flares which are much more energetic, but, up to now, very few so-called superflares have been detected on solar-type stars, making detailed studies impossible. Now, using enormous amounts of data collected by the Kepler satellite, a team of researchers led by Hiroyuki Maehara at Kyoto University have carried out a study of 365 superflares on 148 solar-type stars, making meaningful statistical studies of the phenomenon possible for the first time. The most energetic flare on record from our own sun is known as the Carrington event, which occurred in 1859, a flare which left a detectable trace in polar ice cores on the Earth. But even this event was 10 times weaker than the weakest superflares observed on other stars, some releasing as much as 10 million times as much energy as the Carrington event. Polar ice cores show no evidence of stronger flares from our own sun over the last 2,000 years, while the Kepler data shows that, for the sample of stars in the survey, a superflare occurs on a solar-type star once every 350 years on average. The data also show that superflares occur less frequently on slower-rotating stars, and more often on cooler stars. Brightness variations in the stars which displayed superflares also suggest that they have much larger sunspots than our own sun. Since sunspots and star spots store magnetic energy, the superflares can be explained by large regions of starspot activity. Faster rotating stars display more active magnetic fields and are generally younger than slower rotating stars, and these results suggest that superflares occur more frequently on fast rotating solar type stars younger than the sun. Superflares on stars similar in age to the sun occur less frequently, but release similar amounts of energy. Aside from sunspot activity, one of the theory for the cause of stellar superflares is the magnetic interaction of the star with a so-called hot Jupiter, a large gas giant planet in orbit very close to the star. However, these new results from the Kepler data suggest that such a mechanism is unlikely, since, despite looking, not a single exoplanet has been found orbiting any of the 148 stars which displayed superflares. Kepler makes accurate measurements of stellar brightnesses, looking for the characteristic dimming caused by a planet passing between us and the star, but not every exoplanet will pass directly in front of the star. The probability of a transit is about 10%, averaged over all possible orientations of the planet's orbit. So, if hot Jupiters were responsible for the flare activity seen in this survey, Kepler ought to have detected around 15 of them. Since none were found, it seems that superflares caused by planetary interactions are rare. Over the last couple of years, images from the High-Resolution Imaging Science Experiment, or HiRISE, on board the Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter, have shown many spectacular features on the Martian surface, including clear evidence of wind erosion, sand dune formation, and seasonal avalanches. Now, in a paper published in Nature on the 17th of May, a team led by Nathan Bridges of Johns Hopkins University have found evidence for ongoing large-scale migration of sand dunes, not too different to dune migration seen on the Earth. Mars has a much thinner atmosphere than the Earth, so high wind speeds, needed for the surface movement of material, are much less frequent and generally weaker than on our own planet. Sand dunes on the Earth are seen to migrate, with the entire volume of a dune being overturned as the wind blows the sand along. Although sand dunes have been known about on Mars since the days of the Viking spacecraft, it has long been debated whether they are currently active, or relics left over from a time when the atmosphere of Mars was thicker and the winds were stronger. Now, images of a region known as Nili Patera, taken 3 years apart, have shown evidence that entire dunes, some as thick as 60 metres, are migrating across the surface of the planet at rates not much slower than those measured in some dune fields on the Earth. This result is surprising, since the wind speeds measured by landers on Mars rarely reach high enough to initiate the large-scale transport of sand. One solution may be that local small-scale topography may be able to generate sufficiently large localized winds. Another factor is the lower gravity of Mars, meaning that, once particles are lifted by the wind, they stay airborne more easily than they would on the Earth. Another surprising result is that the formation timescale for these dunes is much less than the timescales of climate fluctuations on the planet, implying that these dunes are not relics from a time when Mars had a thicker atmosphere, but that they could have formed under current climatic conditions. There are, of course, many questions left to be answered, not least whether the level of activity seen in the Nili Patera region is typical of dune regions on Mars, or whether it is unusually active. Further studies of other regions on Mars, utilising the same careful image comparison techniques used by this team, should help answer some of these questions. And finally, After many years, several meticulous site surveys, and thousands of pages of detailed reports, Friday, May 25th saw the long-awaited result of the site selection process for the world's largest radio telescope, the Square Kilometre Array. And, rather than having one single location, the telescope will now be split across two continents. After an initial international call for bids to host the telescope, the options were eventually narrowed down to two sites, Southern Africa and a joint bid by Australia and New Zealand. In both cases, the core of the telescope, consisting of a large proportion of the total number of antennas, would be constructed in a remote location away from as much man-made interference as possible, such as radio, television and mobile phone signals, with other groups of antennas built at a number of locations spanning distances of several thousand kilometres. The project will be the largest radio astronomy facility on the planet, and will ultimately consist of three different types of antennas, each type covering a different part of the radio band. The dual site option, selected by the SKA's International Board, involves building different types of antennas in the two different locations, which, since the different technologies will operate independently, makes use of the existing infrastructure at the two candidate sites where precursor telescopes have already been under construction for a couple of years. The first phase of the project, SKA-1, will see 180 dishes added to South Africa's Meerkat precursor telescope, forming a telescope with a narrow field of view but a high sensitivity, while 60 dishes will be added to ASCAP, the Australian precursor, forming an array with a wider field of view but lower sensitivity, designed to carry out faster surveys of the sky. SKA-1 also includes many thousands of dipole antennas distributed over the Australian site, forming an array working at low frequencies. By incorporating the existing precursor instruments, the completed SKA Phase 1 will have greater capabilities than originally planned. The decision was welcomed by both of the bidding countries, although some onlookers have raised concerns over cost increases that may be incurred by constructing a dual-site telescope. However, due to the already existing infrastructure at both sites, and the need for separate cores for each of the components anyway, operating across two sites will add no more than 10% to the projected cost of Phase 1, according to John Womersley, chair of the SKA Board of Directors. For Phase 2 of the construction, expected to be completed around 2024, all the dishes and the mid-frequency aperture arrays will be built in Southern Africa, while all of the low-frequency antennas for Phase 1 and Phase 2 will be built in Australia.